Good evening, and you are very welcome to this week's episode of Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. I'm your host, Aisling O'Rourke, and each week we try to take perhaps an alternative look at environmental issues and give you some tips and tricks on how we can do our bit to support climate action, but also maybe taking a different perspective on the problems that we are facing as our environment changes around us. And we've got a lovely show packed up for you this evening. But first thing this evening, I want to talk about all of these efforts to encourage more of us to cycle to work and to school and maybe to walk more and leave the car home more. But as I've mentioned on air, over my time on air, I live with invisible disability, and it's always, I suppose, not necessarily bugged me, but it's always made me curious as to whether or not people with disability are being included in the conversation about the climate crisis and how we need to make changes in order to tackle the climate crisis. So to discuss this a little bit more, I'm joined by Emily Larkin of Disability Ireland. Emily, you are Invisible Disability Ireland. You are most welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So Emily, first things first, because as I said, I live with invisible disability. So for me, it's a phrase that I would use on the regular, but for others, it's something new. So what is invisible disability?
Yeah, an invisible disability is a disability, an illness or a condition that is less apparent, it's internal or it's invisible. So you can't see what's maybe going on inside that person's body. And it can range from mental health, such as, you know, depression, anxiety, chronic illness, such as diabetes or haemophilia, to lots of other different conditions like dyslexia and autism. So it's a very, very broad word, but that would be the main gist of it.
And why did you, like, I know over on Instagram, you have been incredibly active setting up Invisible Disability Ireland, but what brought you to setting it up?
For me, it was just the continual frustration over the lack of awareness and understanding towards invisible disabilities. When I would explain it, people really wouldn't understand, or they say, oh, I've never really heard about that before. And when I went to look up invisible disability charities in Ireland, there wasn't anything. And I realized that this is why there was such a lack of education and awareness, is because no one was doing that. So that's why I set it up, and it was set up 3 years ago now.
And I know, like, even as a college student myself, I had to go to a separate exam centre anytime that I had an exam. Not because anything was likely to happen to me, but because I might need to take a break and have something to eat or to check my blood sugars because I'm type 1 diabetic. And that might actually cause a disturbance to somebody else sitting an exam. So I was always given, you know, a room of my own or in a smaller centre. And I remember somebody saying to me when I was doing my undergrad, why are you never there on exam day? Like, and I was trying to explain this to them, because, ah, yeah, but your diabetes, that's not a disability. So you're not in a wheelchair. And I do think,
wow.
Yeah. And I, that was a long time ago that this person said that to me. And I think very fondly of that particular person. We're very good friends. But I do think in Ireland, our attitude to what a disability is needs a bit of education, in that I think there's an assumption that to have a disability, you need to look in some way different.
Yeah, I always talk about how, you know, the international symbol of disability is a person in a wheelchair. So that is naturally the first thing that comes to mind for people. It's kind of the most obvious disability, or the first thing that people would think of. And it's the most apparent, naturally. So we have this built-in misconception and bias towards what a disability is. And, you know, the statistic is 80% of all disabilities are invisible. So that's a massive proportion of the disabled population that don't look disabled. And that's why there is this kind of lack of awareness and understanding, because you can't see conditions like dyspraxia, you know, like ADHD, like arthritis, fibromyalgia, whatever it may be. So this is why it's so important that we bridge the gap and say, yes, that is what some disabilities look like, but this is also what disability looks like as well.
And I know, and I'm saying this because I've experienced it, where people might feel a negative connotation to the term disability, that they don't want to identify as having a disability. And people have very strong feelings around what it means to have a disability. And like, I remember like looking at it up years ago on the Oxford English Dictionary definition of was anything that affects your quality or length of life. And like, when we think about it in those terms, it is such a broad spectrum, isn't it, really?
Yeah, like you're right that the meaning of disability is very broad. It's an impairment that, you know, makes a person less abled or they can't follow out their daily tasks. So that is so broad and wide. And I think we do have a negative perception to even say 1980s Ireland, where there was a lot of shame and stigma associated around disability. And it's only quite recently we've started to move out of that slowly but surely. But there is this negative kind of association of having a disability. And it is tough. Disability isn't a bad word, but people can often see it as that. So it's really important that we celebrate people with disability and we show all the good things. It's not, there's lots of amazing and great things that have happened because of my disability.
And do you mind talking to me about how your invisible disability affects your day to day?
Yeah, I would have multiple chronic illnesses. So mine being arthritis, my fibromyalgia, and then a heart condition. So most days I could wake up maybe a little bit sore, a little bit stiff. And, you know, my pain levels might be not so good, but particularly the fatigue is the biggest thing that impacts me. And so there's just a lot of management, as I'm sure you know, around chronic illness. It's taking your injections, taking your tablets, making sure you're going to all your hospital appointments, picking up your prescriptions. For me, it's doing my physiotherapy. And it is this constant stream of things and to-do lists that you have to get through. And it's only recently I've been talking a lot about chronic illness burnout and how severe it can be for people having to constantly look after yourself 24/7. And for diabetics, in order to literally survive and to live, it can be physically exhausting. I know my friend has spoken about it. It's really hard work looking after yourself every single day with an illness. Yeah.
And like, I know, like I have a number of autoimmune diseases and I also have fibromyalgia, but for me, the type 1 diabetes, I probably focus more on that. And I know that statistically, if you're type 1 diabetic in particular, you're more likely to suffer from depression as a direct result of having the disability. And like, we don't talk about that. We don't offer support services for anything like that. Like it is such a hidden struggle because perhaps we have this element of shame around addressing people with disability. And yeah. I have to wonder, and I was thrilled. I can't remember when I discovered your campaign, but I was thrilled to see somebody talking about it online and taking on that job, because that job in and of itself is a lot of work, you know? Have you been, how has the response been to putting yourself out there and creating this group to support people with invisible disability in Ireland?
Yeah, the response has been amazing. And I think one of the biggest things people say is, how did I not discover this page earlier? Because, you know, we are quite new. We're not a full-time charity. We're, you know, a part-time nonprofit, realistically. But yeah, the response is always amazing because I'm talking about things that maybe people don't always hear. And it's like that when I see someone talking about illness, I just love it because they're sharing very similar journeys and experiences and stories that you relate to. And you can really see yourself in that person. You can gain so much knowledge from listening to other people. And yeah, I think the response has always been amazing and people are so appreciative, which is lovely because, you know, so much hard work and my free time and my passion goes into it. But the hope is to just keep growing and keep talking about it because it's not going away. It's here to stay. So it's just trying to get that awareness up as much as possible.
And it has genuinely been heartening to see different people use your platform to explain what their day-to-day life is like and how things affect them. And to recognize that talking about living with disability is not all woe is me. It's just, you know what? Yeah, I deal with that too. And it's really nice to see that somebody else suffers from chronic fatigue as well and has to take a nap in the middle of the day, even though they're only in their 30s or whatever it might be, you know? So it's such a positive account. So I was thrilled to see this, to see somebody taking up the mantle of this work, because I do recognize that, you know, it's a lot of work that you've taken on your own shoulders. So this show, Emily, we try to focus in on environmental issues and everything around not only the climate crisis, but the environment in general and how we can do our bit to support it. And there's been so much conversation, so many conversations around our transportation in particular and the negative effects of, you know, using the car to go everywhere and how we should all be hopping on the bicycle. Or maybe even like if you live in a rural area, there's going to be a park and ride facility in the local village. And so you can just walk to that and, you know, use that to get in. And I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, but like I'm one of those lucky people with invisible disability in that it only affects my mobility on a personal level. On an on and off basis, it's not a regular day to day for me. And I'm thinking about people who have mobility issues, maybe don't have the energy to walk long distances, don't have the ability to walk long distances, maybe have a wheelchair and all, or it's very hard sometimes to get a wheelchair accessible bus or taxi, you know, depending on where you are. You know, from your perspective, are we leaving out people with disability in the conversations that we're having around adjusting to the climate crisis?
Absolutely. If you look at Bus Éireann, a lot of their fleets are still, you know, not wheelchair accessible. You have to ring 24 hours in advance in order to get a wheelchair ramp to use the train.
Yeah.
You know, there's only one wheelchair spot on Dublin Bus. So if that's taken up, and I often hear people talk about it, you know, people with prams don't move out of the space, even though, you know, it's there for them. There's lots of issues surrounding people with disabilities accessing public transport, and it's not good enough. Considering people with disabilities who are on, like, for example, disability allowance, they have free travel for that reason. They need access through public transport in order to avail of a more independent life. And that's kind of been taken away from them. I think it has improved, and it would be, you know, I wouldn't want to not, you know, acknowledge that. But we do have quite a long way to go, particularly in rural areas. And now this transition of, you know, in order to protect the environment. I know people have been very upset the way they've been pedestrianising streets, particularly in Dublin, and they've taken away wheelchair accessible spots. And this can have massive implications for someone with a disability. For example, if they have reduced mobility for whatever reason, they can't walk or they're a wheelchair user, that now massively impacts maybe if they're working or recreational or whatever else they're doing in town. And so people are being kind of taken out of the conversation and not being asked, hey, listen, is this okay? And if it's happening, then alternative provisions should be put in place. We'll say, listen, this street's closing, but we've decided to add extra spaces to the street adjacent to it. Okay, brilliant. You know, a problem solution. But I do think on public transport, it is getting better. You know, we have introduced the Please Offer Me a Seat badge and card for people with invisible disabilities. So that will make public transport a lot more accessible for people with hidden conditions, which is brilliant. And, you know, it's little initiatives like that that will help people with disabilities to access transport. But there'll always be things we need to improve on. But I think it's having, like you said, that voice and that seat at the table in order to ensure that it's done correctly.
Would you like to sit down with the various ministers for the environment? Because we do have Eamon Ryan in the senior cabinet position, and then we have his junior minister, and of course, Pippa Hackett being the minister from the Midlands in the Department of the Environment. Would you like to see them sit down with people like you and other disability campaigners to just have the conversation and just discuss possible ways they could address the issue?
Absolutely. I think it's always beneficial when a minister maybe listens to people from minority backgrounds or, you know, people that their decisions affect. I think it's a really interesting conversation, disability and environmental change. I saw recently an article on how the health service and hospitals account for a massive percentage of pollution and what they're looking to do to change. As naturally, you know, a lot of the things are they can only use once and they have to throw away, and their consumption, things like plastic cups and plates for inpatients. So I think there could be a really interesting conversation on disability and the environment. Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned the please offer me a seat badge for public transport. What exactly is it?
Yeah, so we launched this in conjunction with TFI, Transport for Ireland. And basically, you're allowed to pick it up, you know, across train stations, bus stations, or you can contact your local link, who also have the seat, please offer me a seat badge and card. And basically what it does is you can wear it or you can present it to the priority seating, on buses. And you're basically asking people to offer them, you know, the accessible seat that's there for them. But because they don't get it immediately, it's because their disability is less apparent or hidden. So that those seats up the top of the bus, they are for you, but because you don't look disabled, you know, quote unquote disabled, you wouldn't be offered the seat. So it's all about saying, well, actually, this person does need to be offered the seat. They just don't look, you know, quote unquote disabled. So it's really trying to show people that there are people with hidden conditions who do need to sit down, and the feedback has been amazing. It's just made people's journeys so much more easier for them.
What about people who would say, oh God, I don't like that idea. Like, yes, I need that priority seat, but I don't really feel I don't want to put myself out there and let somebody know that I have a medical condition. It feels like maybe an invasion of privacy.
Yeah, that's all, and that is a tough question. You know, do I disclose my disability to other people I don't know? But I think it is discreet enough. You know, it's a small enough badge, and generally, it only happens during very bad peak hours. Generally, you are able to get a seat for transport, but it is up to that person. But the hope is that it catches on and people use it and wear it all the time. You know, we're looking at just under 500,000 people in Ireland who live with a disability, so it's not rare, it's not uncommon, but it's definitely encouraging people to use the badge and have the confidence to do so.
I was in Japan a couple of years ago, you know, back when we all could travel freely. And I remember seeing on the trains, they had stickers inside the window and in English and in Japanese, because at the time they were getting ready for the World Cup. So everything was getting an English translation. They had like, you know, this area is priority seating for those who need to have mobility issues, those who are in wheelchairs, and also those who have less apparent disabilities. Or there was a note that said, remember, not all disabilities are visible. And it was like, I had never seen anything like that before. And I was like, oh, finally. Because you get that sense of judgment if you need the priority seat, say on a Dublin bus, and perhaps maybe an elderly person who also clearly needs a seat too comes towards you, but maybe you're in an awful lot of pain and you just can't get up at that moment in time. You know, you get the look as if to say, well, you're young, what, like you're just being rude. And there is that sense of judgment that, you know, well, how dare you take that seat? Clearly, because you're young, you're fine. And maybe we all need to just have a second thought before passing judgment on others when it comes to public transport and the priority seating, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we do just make snap judgments. We make unconscious bias decisions all the time. You know, you don't know what's going on in someone's life, and someone's body. So it is your best trying to be cognizant of that. You won't always remember that when you're commuting home at 6 o'clock after a long day at work. You won't be think it's not the first thing on your mind when you see a young person sitting down. But just saying that person could have, you know, a hidden disability. And, you know, Ireland is behind in comparison to a lot of Western countries, but we are hopefully beginning to catch up now. And that's the aim, that we do hit the gold standard, and Ireland is the example and leads the way on stuff like this.
So, Emily, tell me once again, where does one get a please offer me a seat badge or card?
Yeah, so you can pick them up at any train station across the country, any bus stations. Or you can look at the website for the local link and locations where you can pick them up across the country.
Fantastic. And if Minister Eamon Ryan happens to be listening into Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, what is your message to him tonight?
Just to include people with disabilities, as some of the decisions do affect them, and just to ensure that while we're looking after the environment, we're also looking after people with a disability.
Well, Emily Larkin of Invisible Disability Ireland, I do recommend that you go and check out Emily's work. Her Instagram page is a font of information and full of positivity, I should add. So thank you so much for your time, Emily. I really enjoyed our chat.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands103.com. Well, what do you make of my conversation with Emily Larkin of Invisible Disability Ireland there? Like, are we leaving people out of the climate change conversation? I, for one, think we are. I don't think it's through any kind of nastiness or an attempt to discriminate. I think that for much of the conversation around climate change, we're in crisis mode because it is a crisis. So we're perhaps not thinking things through in a long-term strategy as we might do were we not in a crisis. That's just my opinion on it. But, you know, as I said, looking at streets that have been pedestrianised and noticing that, oh, there's also a doctor's surgery on that street. How does somebody get to the doctor's surgery when they're sick and not really all that mobile? You know, sometimes it doesn't add up, and sometimes we need a bit of logical thinking, you know, and a bit of long-term planning instead of ad hoc crisis time solutions. But to talk more about the climate change crisis, to talk more about where we are at now, we're going to be looking at a new report released by the world's meteorologists in the last couple of days with Professor John Sweeney after the break. And he's going to be giving us his take on the science behind climate change and where we're at this moment in time. And of course, if you are enjoying listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, don't forget that we are available as a podcast on all the podcast platforms. We're on Spotify, Apple, and indeed Google Podcasts. All you have to do is go into your preferred podcast app and search Let's Go Green with Aisling O'Rourke. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, and I hope you've been enjoying our show so far this evening. Well, we're joined now by Professor John Sweeney. Now, Professor Sweeney, you are nearly Midlands 103's environmental expert at this stage. John, I think we need to give you an official title at this stage, but you're welcome to the show.
Thanks, Aisling.
Now, Professor, it's been an interesting week in that we've had this global report released last week telling us that Europe is warming at a higher rate than elsewhere in the globe. But we also this week have COP27. So, you know, maybe now the media is paying a little bit more attention than we would ordinarily at these issues. But this report that tells us that Europe, the continent of Europe, is warming at a greater rate than elsewhere, how concerning is it?
Well, Europe, as we know, is a continent which has a great deal of landmass attached to it. And landmasses tend to warm up quicker, as we know, than the oceans. So when we talk about the globe as a whole, we're including the Pacific and the Indian and the Atlantic Oceans and so on, which tend to absorb heat and mix it up to great depths so that the surface doesn't warm to the same extent with the same rapidity as land masses do. So we've known for a long time that the interiors of the continents like Asia, Europe, North America, they warm quicker than the rest of the world. But in Europe's case, there's also the complicating factor that we have a lot of very high latitude zones in Europe, which are covered by snow and ice, which we know is also diminishing. And as time goes on and the replacement of that shiny white surface by darker land surfaces means that the land can absorb more energy, more radiation, and so it warms up a little more quickly than it would otherwise. So for both of those reasons, it's not too surprising that Europe is warming a bit quicker. We know the Arctic is warming 3 or 4 times quicker than the globe as a whole for those very reasons as well. So it does tell us, however, that we have to be, I think, cautious in how we interpret some of those global average figures that are sometimes thrown at us about 1.5 degrees of warming or 2 degrees of warming, which are the Paris targets that we set way back in 2015 that we would do our best to avoid hitting those particular points. Because it means that for Europe, we're going to experience maybe 3 or 4 degrees of warming with those kinds of levels. Now, in Ireland, We're a wee bit luckier than the mainland of Europe because we're surrounded by ocean, and so we're warming up perhaps only as the global average warms rather than the continent of Europe as a whole. So we've warmed up here in Ireland by around 0.6, 0.7 degrees so far, and that's a wee bit less than the European average, but it will ultimately catch up with the global average because we're a mid-latitude country, so we can't be complacent really about it, and we have to take steps to adapt and take steps to play our part internationally in ensuring that Europe, as with the rest of the world, avoids some of those key tipping points at which unforeseen and possibly irrecoverable things may happen on the planet.
John, I remember during the summer when we had those. Now, in fairness, like I know, like lots of people, I enjoyed going to the beach and all of that this summer when we got the good weather. And it was fabulous to be swimming in the Irish Sea. I thoroughly enjoyed myself. But at the back of my mind, I was thinking, this is great for now, but we were seeing a lot on social media at the time going, yeah, this is possibly the coolest summer we're going to have for some time. And now it kind of, it looks like while that might have been the comment on social media, this, the science might be backing this up. Would I be right in thinking that?
You would be right in thinking that it was an exceptionally warm summer. It may be, and I think it's very unlikely we'll get a summer like that again, maybe this year or next year, but it would be the kind of summer that we'd be seeing more frequently in the years ahead. We've done some climate scientists have done a little analysis of the heat wave conditions that applied in England and Ireland during this summer. And what they've done is quite interesting. They've run climate models with pre-industrial levels of greenhouse gases, maybe 50 or 100 times. They've run them then with the current levels of greenhouse gases, the same number of times roughly. And they've asked the computer, how often would you get a summer like we had here in Britain and Ireland in 2022 in pre-industrial times as opposed to today? And what comes out is that the summer we had, the heat wave we had, was about twice as likely to have occurred as a consequence of what we've done to the atmosphere. So the kind of summer you're talking about there, well, it's going to be twice as likely to occur into the future. And of course, we may even therefore get more extreme summers than we had this year as a consequence of that probability change. But it won't happen every year. We'll get miserable summers again like we've had in the past. You can be sure of it. But what we're looking at is the trend overall going towards those warmer, drier conditions. And of course, it was lovely this summer to enjoy the sunshine, to enjoy the heat. And that will be something that Ireland really won't suffer too much from in the immediate few decades. What we have to worry about in Ireland is not the temperature changes so much as the rainfall changes that will be brought with that warmer condition. And we've seen a little inkling of that this year, because if you think of the last 2 months, we had a really wet September and October. I think if you're thinking of Mullingar, I looked at it this morning and there was more rainfall in October in Mullingar than there was in June, in May, June and July combined. So, you know, that's the kind of conditions that we get when the oceans around us warm up and when the air coming off that ocean, especially in the autumn and winter, is loaded very heavily with water vapour and therefore gives us those rainfall extremes that we've been seeing in the past few months as well.
John, I've noticed that, like driving around the Midlands, and I've been commenting on it even when I arrived home the other day, like it is very visible the amount of water that's on farmlands here in the Midlands at the moment. And for me, looking at it as somebody born and raised in the Midlands, it seems unusually early in the season to have that level of water. But then you'll have maybe those from the agricultural sector arguing that, well, look, we can make all of these changes, but this is a global problem and we're kind of helpless. And you'll have not, well, to be honest, a lot of people here saying that there's very little we can do to make change in relation to this, that we're only a small player. How true is that? Like you mentioned earlier that we could be making changes, but how much of an impact can we have as this wee island nation?
Well, of course, we are a small contributor to the overall problem in absolute terms. But we can't point the finger at other countries and say you should be doing more if we are doing less. We in Ireland, we emit more greenhouse gases than the 400 million poorest people living on the planet. So if we turn around and say to the farmers in the Horn of Africa, sorry, lads, we're not doing too much to cause your problem, so we're going to carry on as before. That's not really ethically and morally correct to do. And it's also something which I think gives a legacy to the next generation when, you know, our grandchildren will say, why didn't you do a bit more, Granda or Grandma, when you had the chance? Now, we can't therefore point the finger. We in Ireland have made commitments under our European regulations, under our national regulations, and we're not delivering on those, even nationally and domestically. So it behoves us, I think, to pull our weight and not point the finger at other countries. Some other countries have big problems in trying to meet their obligations that we, you know, they're pulling themselves out of poverty. We are not. And a very interesting report has come out which says that the top 10% of the world's population are responsible for 50% of the world's emissions. So there's a real climate justice issue there, where I think we have to accept that historically and at present, we in Ireland are contributing to the problem disproportionately, much, much more than other parts. I think, you know, the whole of Africa contributes at less than 10% of global emissions, the whole of Africa. And, you know, I think we can't very well say to them, we are going to carry on as normal, despite the fact that we are contributing so much more disproportionately to your problems. And that's an ethical issue of climate justice, which if we want to run away from, we'll have no credibility in the global community.
Now, I know you are a passionate speaker on these issues and passionate about education around the topic. I'm just wondering, you know, we're heading into a winter where we're going to have a change up at the cabinet table in government. We're going to have Leo Varadkar back in as Taoiseach in late December. You know, what are you and your colleagues calling for? What actions should we be taking at this moment in time?
Well, we hear a great deal of issues in the media talking about our obligations for 2030, talking about our obligations for 2050. And, you know, that in a sense is kicking the problem down the road again. I've seen a lot of that happen over the past 30 years where, you know, it's very easy to say, oh, it's going to be the next government's responsibility to tackle this. But I think we now have a situation where we have a 2025 carbon budget limit to reach. We've already used up about 36% of it between 2021 and 2025. So I think what we should be calling for is, are you serious about meeting those 2025 limits? And if so, what immediate urgent steps are you proposing to take to ensure that that 295 million ton limit that we have for that 5-year period is not breached? Because at the moment, I don't see a strong commitment to actually achieving that. And I think, you know, the politics really are going to get in the way, as I see it, of what we have to do legally and what we have to do morally to meet those obligations. So I don't think the change of leadership will affect that all that much, to tell you the truth. I think the three government parties are really committed to tackling climate change. But tackling climate change in the short term is what I want to see personally, rather than tackling it in some distant future, 5-10 years down the road, because we don't have the time. The IPCC have told us 45% reduction in emissions by 2030 if we want to have any chance of avoiding some of those tipping points. And, you know, if we sit back and wait for 2030 to happen, especially now that our economy is recovering again after COVID, then I think it will be too late to actually take the steps we need to take. So I think urgency in the short term. I'm an old man in a hurry, I think I could describe myself as at this stage, having preached about this for so long. I don't think we have the luxury of kicking for touch anymore.
John, like we're seeing, you know, in Spain and in continental Europe in the last number of weeks, we're seeing these unusually warm temperatures for the autumn period in particular. Like, I think, am I right in saying a part of Spain in the last couple of weeks had something like 30 or 30, 31 degree heat in October?
You are. Much of Spain actually had over 30 degrees in October, and parts of the south of Spain near Seville actually got up to 34.9 degrees in October, which is really exceptional for that month, if you think about it. And the same in the rest of Europe. It was exceptionally warm in Germany. It was over 25. In the UK, it got to really warm temperatures over 20 as well. We in Ireland didn't get above 20, but we still had a very mild October and a mild autumn. And that's been something that's quite exceptional in some ways. We had a very similar Indian summer, if you want to call it that, last year as well, when the temperatures were very similar. And in fact, rather ironically, over many parts of Ireland in October, it was warmer than it was in May this year, which is, again, something that doesn't normally happen. But it's had consequences. If you look out your window today, you'll see the trees are all at different stages of autumn development. And some of those have already turned, some of them have lost their leaves already, like lime trees and so on. Others, like beech, are beginning to turn lovely shades of yellow. And others are still very green, like the oak tree. And some of that is a response to the stresses of the drought earlier in the year, where trees are defending themselves for the winter to come. But it means that, unlike many autumns, when all the colours change almost at the same time, this autumn we're seeing a kaleidoscope of change happening. And it's telling us that the seasons have got a wee bit out of kilter at the moment. And also, it's telling us that there are problems going to be emerging for some of the wildlife. I mean, we had, in parts of England, we had blackberries ripening at the end of June. We had berries on the holly tree occurring in July.
John, we've a holly bush in our own back garden, which I think my father planted in or around 2002, 2003. We've got berries on it at the moment. It's never had berries. Like, we have flowers, you see them, it's still in bloom. Like, I was at a family member's garden the other day, and all their dahlias are still gorgeous looking. And you're thinking, what on earth is happening?
You're right. I mean, it's quite exceptional. We've only, I think, had one day of air frost so far in County Roscommon this year. We've hardly any frost, which we normally would have had a few days of frost at this time of the year. But there's a problem with those berries, and there's a problem with that kind of sequence of events, because it creates a lack of chronology, a lack of synchronicity between the food supply, for example, that birds and insects need. And what's happening. It creates problems for animals that should be hibernating by now. And that's part and parcel of what we're going to have to cope with, I think, in the years ahead as well. That difficulty whereby the normal sequence of the seasons, the normal sequence of food supply and hibernation is getting disrupted a bit by these kinds of odd seasonal changes that we're seeing.
Well, Professor John Sweeney, Midlands 103's resident climate expert, thank you so much for being so generous with your time today and for joining us on Let's Go Green on Midlands103.com. Thank you very much for listening to our show this evening. I would be very interested in hearing what you thought of tonight's conversations and their contributions from both Emily Larkin of Invisible Disability Ireland and indeed Professor John Sweeney of Maynooth University. You can get in contact with me directly through midlands103.com. Just search for Aisling O'Rourke under On Air Team, and you can tell me what you think. Are they, you know, do you agree with what Emily says? Do we need to look at people with disabilities more when we're planning to make these changes around our infrastructure in order to become a more climate aware society? And what do you make of what John Sweeney says? Do we need to put pressure on our politicians to actually take action on the promises that they have made? This is, of course, COP27 week. You know, it is the week when lots more promises are going to be made. But, you know, what about action? What is actually going to be done? It's all very well making these promises, but we also have to stick to our word if we have any chance of turning around the climate change crisis. That's all I have time for on this week's episode of Let's Go Green. Have a great week. Stay safe, and we'll be back same time next week.